Hey, how's it going, everybody? This is Chris. Welcome to episode 30 of NML Crossing, where we've got us quite the offbeat issue to discuss today. We're back in Anthology Land with another issue of Batman Chronicles. It's actually not the next issue. You know, last time we talked about Chronicles, it was issue number 12. And I guess 13 was a team-up issue. Like all the, you know, the little anthology stories were Batman team-ups that didn't have anything to do with the current status quo or anything relevant to our, you know, little mission statement here. So instead of talking about 13, we got issue 14. We're going to talk about Batman Chronicles number 14, which had a fall 1998 cover date. We've got three stories, all of which are edited by Vincenzo and Gorfinkel, and our book has a cover price of $2.95. Let's get right into it, because we got a lot of stuff to cover here. Well, at least it looks like a lot on my screen. It might not be. I guess we'll see as we go. Our first story is called Master of the House, and every time I see that, I can't get like a George Costanza singing that, you know, Master of the House out of my head, so that's been in my, in my little radio station in my head for the entire weekend. This one's written by Lisa Klink with pencils by David Bowler. Inks Aaron Soud, colors Noel Giddings, and letters by Albert de Guzman. Now, this is a weird one. Now, we open, we're outside Wayne Manor, where a team of would-be home invaders are about to strike. The manor, of course, is in quite the state of disrepair, which would make getting in far less of a challenge than pre-quake, of course. It's July 3rd, by the way. That'll be sort of important later on. Now, inside, Alfred is the only person home. And he's trying to sleep, but it's too hot. And so he decides to treat himself to a sponge bath. That's not a sentence I ever thought I'd say. And it's also a series of panels I didn't think I'd ever actually see, but here we are. We follow Alfie into the kitchen where he fetches a basin full of rainwater? A basin full of... Seriously? Okay. He strips off his robe and proceeds to give himself the ickiest looking sponge bath ever captured in four color. Now, the suds on his back look like clumps of cottage cheese. It's really quite foul. The sponge bath is, thankfully, interrupted by the power going out. Alfred peeks out the window to see the goon squad making their way across the vast Wayne lawn. And gang, I can't overstate it here. They look like geeks. Now, Alfred knows that he needs to defend the house. It's very, you know, Kevin McAllister or whatever the kid from Home Alone's name was, because we are going directly into a Home Alone situation, minus the swinging paint cans. Now, next we know the invaders have made their way inside, and it turns out they have absolutely no plan. Like, they know they want to steal something. They just haven't the foggiest idea what. Now, one of them suggests that Wayne must have a hidden vault or storage room where all the best stuff is kept. Well, that's a lucky guess, isn't it? Now, he tells everyone else to grab whatever they want, but he is going to focus on this potential big score. Now, Alfred Zeri overhears the plan, or I guess lack of plan, and he quietly retreats back to his room. The thing of it is, he's still dripping wet from his cottage cheese bath, so he's left a trail of soggy footprints all along the way. He tries radioing Master Bruce from a very primitive-looking little, like it's almost like a Morse code machine. It's very bizarre. But before he can do so, he's found by one of the baddies, so he can't establish contact. And this baddie is named Meeks. Now, Meeks radios another baddie named Quinn. Probably not that Quinn, otherwise we're going to have to slab this issue after reading. Now, Meeks says that he found the butler. And while Alfred's being marched, I think, toward a closet, he, like, swats a baseball off the table against the wall, which bounces back behind Meeks. Now, Alfred lets out a shriek that it's Bruce's prized Mickey Mantle baseball. Now, this distracts Meeks long enough for Alfred to smash his brains in with a baseball bat. So I guess R.I.P. Meeks. I don't know how you survive something like that. Alfred then picks up Meeks's radio and affects some sort of accent and tells the rest of the gang that he's taken care of the butler. We rejoin a couple of the other invaders as they're looking for any sort of loot to take with them. They spy a china cabinet with the Wayne silver stashed in it. And so the sole woman invader opens it, which triggers a test tube to tip into a tiny beaker, which causes some sort of terrible chemical reaction. Maybe they're being blissed. I don't know. I don't think Alfred had the time to rig this gimmick in the last 5 seconds, so this looks like quite the handy little coincidence, right? Now the gal passes out, and Alfred's here? I guess somehow he did find the time to rig this gimmick. I'm not sure how or when, but I suppose we have very little choice but to allow it. We next join the fellow who was just with the woman not 2 seconds ago, the other invader here. But he's now up in Alfred's room, where he discovers Meeks knocked out, or dead. I mean, he did have his brain splattered with a baseball bat. Now, this guy's name is Rodriguez, and he calls this in to Quinn. Quinn just tells Roddy to take care of the butler, because he's too busy. You see, he thinks he's on to something here, something big. And we see him standing atop the fissure above the Batcave, so clearly he's headed in the right direction. Now, Alfred, he's still listening in on Meeks's radio, so he knows he's got to act quickly, lest the secret be spoiled. Now, as he walks through the kitchen, he narrowly avoids being shot in the head by Rodriguez. Alfred then hits the ground and scrambles towards some kitchen cabinets. Now, Rodriguez has him cornered. Well, you'd think he was cornered, but now Alfred's outside somehow? This is really, like, the weirdest chase scene I've read in a long time. Is, like, Wayne Manor procedurally generated? Is it, like, a roguelike? Is there, like, a mother box inside a mother box sort of thing? Like, how the hell are they teleporting like this? Anyway, Alfred's there, and he's got a lit match and a stick of dynamite. Okay, it's not dynamite. It just looks like a stick of dynamite. It's actually fireworks. He lights it and tosses it in the air. Now, since Roddy's wearing night vision goggles, the light show totally messes him up. And, oh yeah, all of the robbers are wearing night vision goggles. I probably should have mentioned that. Now, Alfred lights several more firecrackers before heading toward the fissure. As he runs, we get a bit of exposition. Now, you see, before the elder Waynes went to watch Zorro that fateful night, they used to host fireworks shows every 4th of July. And, well, that's a tradition that Bruce never picked up. But, as luck would have it, he also never had Alfred clean out the kitchen cabinets, so them firecrackers were all still there, and somehow still viable. Anyway, Alfred makes it to the fissure and tells Quinn to get his ass out of the crack. Quinn is rappelling down, but also has the powers of Mr. Fantastic because he grabs Alfie's ankle and pulls him down with him. This oddly choreographed scene ends with Alfie and Quinn falling to a platform a little ways down the fissure. Quinn nearly falls all the way down, but Alfred manages to catch him. And we find out that old Q had busted his elbow. Alfred climbs up but promises he'll be back real soon with help. Meanwhile, some of Wayne's neighbors see the fireworks show, which is somehow still going on. Did Alfred set like a time delay? Or are we still using Motherbox technology? Whatever the case, a crowd forms to watch the pretty lights. Did Alan Grant ghostwrite this? Probably not, since nobody's referencing the Aurora Borealis. He likes them lights in the sky. Anyway, this takes us to our close. It's the next morning, Bruce gets home just in time for breakfast, and Alfred doesn't even bother to tell him what happened the night before. And these three panels here are Batman's only appearance in today's issue. Our next story is called The Lunatic Fringe, written by Bruce Canwell, with pencils by Jim Aparo and inks by Drew Garrisey. Colors, Jason Wright. Letters, Clem Robbins. And this is a Huntress story. And it starts with Helena on the hunt for a school bus that went missing. Now, she's questioning some scuzzbag called Slug Stavro by dangling him off the edge of a bridge. He finally coughs up that some dude called China Tommy mentioned something about a school bus being over in Skidmore. Helena spares his life, figuring she may need him again in the future. Now, the story here is the school Helena teaches at has now been designated as a relocation center, which, hey, they mentioned schools being used for that in that New York Magazine article, didn't they? Now, she saw this particular bus leave with the world-famous, okay, the not-at-all-famous Leventhal twins on board, but the bus never made it to its destination. Now, since this is a short story, it doesn't take Huntress but a panel to find the bus, and it's empty. Well, there are no people, But there is a Beanie Baby, or a Beanie Binky. Now, she knows that it belongs to Haley Leventhal, one of those, you know, twins. Helena says Haley would never be seen without it. She exits the bus and scans the area, and the only building in decent repair is a Novello Abattoir, a slaughterhouse. She heads inside and sees a table set. As she approaches it, she hears a lot of yipping and woofing and arfing, and so to her left, she sees a bank of cages full of malnourished pups. She heads over to the cages and is nearly shot in the head. The second person in this issue almost shot in the head. Now, it's Danny Lucas, the now crazed cook from the Skidmore Diner, who shot the bullet, and those pups are his livestock. Eesh, you know, we've got them eating dogs, we've got missing kids. I feel like we're about to be getting back into cannibalism again, aren't we? Anyway, Huntress fills the fella with mini crossbow bolts before knocking his ass out. She then unleashes her teeny tiny flashlight, which somehow illuminates the entire rest of this gigantic room. It's like a warehouse. And it reveals six children hanging from meat hooks. Now, this is a code-approved book, so it's not like the hooks are, like, in their backs or anything. They're just tied there. They're tied up on the hooks. Huntress ungags Haley Leventhal and asks where their bus driver's at. Well, she says they already came for him, and they also said they'd be back for the kids real soon. But, you know, they took the driver, they heard some really awful sounds, and then it got really, really quiet. Helena looks over to a pile of rubbish and sees the bus driver, Sam Mulligan's red ball cap. He never took the thing off, apparently. Which, I mean, what a convenient breadcrumb trail we're getting here, right? A Beanie Baby whose owner was never seen without it, and now a ball cap of Sam. In a case it's not clear, Sam's probably been eaten at this point. Huntress is then yoinked back by this roided-out bald geek called Hog, with two G's. He slams Argal into the ground and holds one of those electric knives you might use to, like, cut ham up to her head. He screams that nobody's coming to help Skidmore. All the heroes have abandoned them. And so, they're gonna eat her next. What follows are a couple of pages of fighting and crossbow bolting, with Helena ultimately getting the best of the situation. Now, as she continuously slams Hog's head into the ground, Haley Leventhal cries out for her to stop. What? Why would... Okay. Helena looks up at the talkative twin and assures her that she's one of the good guys. And get this, the kid's all like, "You don't seem like such a good guy." It's like, shut the... Okay. Helena, thinking on her feet, pulls out the Beanie Baby, which somehow makes everything better. I guess. Okay. Helena then unties all the tots and lets out all the dogs, and then holds a sing-along. Seriously, it's Itsy Bitsy Spider all up in this joint. We close out with emergency services showing up and Huntress making herself scarce. Our third and final story is called Random Encounters, written by Greg Rucka with art by Sal Buscema and James Hodgkins. And it's a text story. Oh, okay. It stars the Montoya siblings, Renee and Benny, and happens outside of the ruined Montoya bodega. Now, Benny, he brings a couple of warm beers from the dead fridge out to Renee here, and Renee's there flipping Two-Face's coin. Evidently, Renee saved Two-Face's life from some axe-wielding lunatic. I'm not sure when or where this story happened. Last we saw Harv, he was drowning some cops in a sinkhole, and that was, you know, the last issue of Chronicles we covered. And he did flip his coin at the end of that story, so I'm not sure. Maybe it's a different coin. I don't know. Anyway, some passerby yells at Renee for not letting Two-Face die. And we'll be seeing a lot more between Renee and Harvey during No Man's Land. And I want to say most, if not all, of those stories will be written by the fella writing this one, Greg Rucka. Now, it turns out Renee shot the axe wielder dead, and this triggered a flashback in Benny to his time in the army. Of course, you know, he was in a war zone. There's a lot of death, stuff that still haunts him deeply. He says he still hears the sound of the gunshots, still feels the heat, still feels everything. You know, it's a very, I mean, it's something that sticks with you, I would imagine. Now, this whole mess of, you know, killing and deaths, it was only made worse when he was given a Distinguished Flying Cross medal. Because while the army sees him as a hero, he sees himself as a murderer. Now, Renee tries to tell him that he's not. and goes as far as to say, if he's a murderer, then so is she. And he says it's different, but she ain't buying it. She decides to let the fates decide, and she flips Two-Face's coin to see if her brother is a murderer. It comes up on the scarred side, and so she tells him, yeah, you are a murderer. Then she flips it again, and it comes up scarred a second time. She tells him, yeah, you're like a super murderer. You should probably kill even more people. And Benny says, this ain't funny. She then flips a third time, but it comes up heads, you know, not the scarred side. So she agrees. She says, no, this isn't funny. She goes to flip it for a fourth time, but Benny swipes the coin. He says the coin is meaningless, just random. To which, that was kind of Renee's point in all this. Benny cries out that he took lives. And Renee points out that, yeah, you did. But you also feel remorse, because you're human. And, you know, that he hates that he got this medal because it told him that what he did was right. And it wasn't. You know, it wasn't right. Nor was it wrong. It was just what he had to do. There was no choice in the situation. And if he tries to frame it that way, he could wind up being controlled by a, you know, stupid coin toss gimmick. And if that happens, she says she'll make sure that he's Arkham bound. They hug while Benny points out how easy everything must be for someone like Two-Face. He takes no responsibility for anything. All of his decisions are informed by the flip of a coin. To him, everything's black or white. There's no room for things like ambiguity or guilt. And we close out with Renee, you know, telling him, yeah, more or less, that's life. And that is where we end it. Next time out, we're going to get a sit-rep issue here. We're going to catch ourselves up on everything that's gone down, see where everything's currently standing, and we're going to be looking at the flagship to do so. I think it's Batman 557, maybe 558. Whichever one it is, we'll talk about that one next time. Now, before we get into some thoughts about the issue, we do have some letters here. The Batman Chroniclers is what the letters page is called in Chronicles. I guess that's appropriate. And we're going to start with Steve in California. Now, Steve says that Chronicles number 12 made the Cataclysm feel the most real to him. Said it made the entire story feel more three-dimensional than any of the other stories he's read so far. And, you know, there's definitely a logic to that. Because this one, Chronicles kind of moved away from, you know, the Cape and Cowl set. It was more about the people. It was more about how the survivors are getting along or not getting along. How people are being rescued or not being rescued. It was a pretty sobering and a very necessary chapter to really, you know, drive home some points. You know, it wasn't about heroes, it wasn't about villains, it was about people. People who were dealt a really, really rotten hand. And how they are, you know, how they're dealing with the lemons they were handed, I guess. Or if they even had the ability to. Next up, we got Matt in Massachusetts, who really dug issue 12 as well. And he felt that each of the stories brought different things to the Cataclysm table. He starts by talking about the contract and says that that brought hope, faith, and redemption. And that, of course, is the story where the gangbangers are being contracted by Bruce Wayne to help dig out survivors, and they ultimately do so. Trapped came with false hope and desperation, and that was probably the most sobering story in the entire book. That was where we had a guy who was crying out for help. He was buried in the rubble, and he heard people digging. He heard Robin and some officers digging, and then he heard them find somebody, and then he heard them leave. So he was not long for the world. A Bird with the Hand, that was the Penguin story. He said that brought black humor, which it definitely did. Love Me Two Times was the Two-Face story, and he said that brought guilty chuckles. Little Orphan Andy brought pure pathos and heartbreak. That was the child who lost his family, and that was the capper of the issue, where Leslie Tompkins came and took him away. Finally, House of Cards brought with it a sense of defeat and lost hope. And that was the story narrated by Ra's al Ghul about how, it wasn't a villain that beat Batman. It was his own city. The thing that he swore to protect kind of turned on him by falling apart. So really neat insight there from Matt in Massachusetts. Next up, we got Lyle in Hawaii, who loved the issue, and he's really enjoying the new blood that it's bringing to the Bat books. And he cites Devin Grayson and Chris Renaud specifically. And of course, we know Devin Grayson's going to be around for a long while. She's going to be around all throughout No Man's Land, and then, you know, on to Nightwing and Gotham Knights, I think it is. And Chris Renaud, he's the one who read that New York Magazine article and kind of inspired the entire Cataclysm story. So pretty neat stuff, pretty neat stuff. And it's always kind of cool when you get the new blood into the books here. Sometimes it's I don't know, I hate using terms like gatekeeping, but it's like sometimes you get new writers and you feel like they need to prove themselves. It's like, wait a minute, you're interloping on Mensch, Dixon, and Grant here, so you gotta prove yourself. But sometimes the best thing you can do for a book or a line of books is to bring in some new eyes, some new blood, and some new voices. You know, the example I always go to is the Berganza era of Superman. You know, after the Carlin crew with like Jurgens and Ordway, Simonson, Roger Stern, the stories felt, I don't know, it's like they got a little long in the tooth, right? I think that's just something that happens. When you get too comfortable writing a character or drawing a character, it just becomes, I don't know, it's like you told all the stories you want to tell, and now it's just about keeping the ball rolling. And when they shifted eras into like the Y2K era, and they brought in like Jeff Loeb and the Men of Action guys, that like totally revitalized that little fiefdom of DC books, and it was really exciting. It was a really exciting time. It was the first time since the death that I was interested in reading Superman. So this era of Batman is kind of analogous to that to me, where you have Rucka and Grayson and Brubaker and Bawn will come in. It's going to be an interesting little shakeup to get some new voices in there. Our last letter is from John in Frisco, and he normally doesn't buy Chronicles due to budgetary concerns, but he read a review of issue number 12 in Comics Buyer's Guide and needed to check it out, and he thought it was great. On that note, let's talk about this one. Did we think it was great? Well, to me, it wasn't as good as the last Chronicles we covered. Outside of Rucka, these are creators I'd never heard of before. For both Klink and Canwell, these stories actually comprise half of their DC output, period. Like, we'll see Klink again later on in an issue of Shadow of the Bat. Canwell wrote another issue of Chronicles in 1997, so that's not one we're going to be covering. So not a lot of DC work between them. It looks like Lisa Klink wrote primarily for television. Star Trek Voyager in particular, or especially, I guess, that's what keeps coming up in my admittedly limited search. And I do remember reading, I think it was in that Wizard Batman special, was that Chronicles was going to be used to try to entice writers from other media to try their hand at writing Batman stories. So that tracks, you know, and I mean, no harm, no foul. I think that's a pretty neat thing to do. Nowadays, I feel like they'd probably hand any TV writer the entire line and tell them, do whatever you want, kill whoever you want, whatever you want to do, do it. Where here, it's like, okay, you're untested, so here's an anthology. To me, that's definitely the more respectful way to do something like this. Now, Canwell is a real-ass comics historian, not like me being a fake-ass one. He would go on to write for IDW's Library of American Comics imprint. I believe he's also the head editor on that line as well. Never read those, but they do sound like they'd be something right up my alley. Now, as for Rucka, we know Rucka, right? I like him a lot, but I don't care for tech stories in comics. They just never work for me, and I wind up glossing over them. I have very limited mental resources or capacity, so it's like I gotta turn a dial. You know, if I'm reading prose, that's cool, I could do whatever. But when I'm reading comics, it's kind of like, you know, you're driving on highway and then you hit dirt road. You know, it's hard for me to stop, slow down, and focus on big old paragraphs of texts. Now, that said, Rucka's bit was probably the star of the show this time out. And that's probably due to my own biases here, because one of the very few things I do remember from those abridged No Man's Land collections was that odd Rene Montoya Two-Face relationship. So it's cool to get some backstory for that here. I do wish there might have been some, like, editor's notes to, like, tell us if if the story where she shot this axe-wielding lunatic and saved Two-Face's life, if this did occur on panel, I think I'd want to check it out. And, you know, I actually tried combing through all the Two-Face's appearances, hoping to find it. But I tell you, the DC Wiki really, really sucks when it comes to that sort of thing. Like, you look at the DC Wiki and the Marvel Wiki, and they look alike, right? But they don't operate the same. The Marvel Wiki is so much better in that regard. Like, if you click on a character's appearances on the Marvel one, you could actually sort it by appearance, like, by date. So you can get, like, an entire character's history just going down the line. DC does it alphabetically. So it's like, it's going to be all the Action Comics, all the Batman, all the Detective. It makes it a lot harder to navigate, especially if you're doing something like this. The Marvel one was great. It made it so much easier when I was putting together things like the roadmap for the Essential X-Lapsed. You know, especially those X-Men appearances during the reprint era. You know, where it's like, okay, Iceman showed up in this issue of Spider-Man. And it's just everything's in chronological order, so you can place it. And I can actually trip ticket on my silly little, you know, flow chart. And, I mean, that never actually wound up coming to pass, unfortunately, but, it was a useful tool all the same. And I mean, never say never. All right. So let's stop vamping here. Let's stop vamping and talk about the stories. The Alfred Home Alone story, maybe besides the nasty sponge bath, it was cute enough. Though, like I said, the pacing was kind of all over the place. You know, I joked about there being, like, mother box technology in the manor because, no joke, people were just popping up all over the place. It's like, dude's in the living room, dude's in Alfred's room, Alfred's inside, Alfred's outside, he's planting traps in china cabinets. Like, what? The hell? Okay. But even with all that, at the end of the day, it was a fun little story. And it did give Alfie a nice little opportunity to shine because he definitely wasn't going to be getting much screen time in the main books. Like, at this point, he's basically just there to relay messages from Lucius Fox to Bruce and to sometimes watch Harold work. That's about it. Now, the Huntress story was a bit convenient. The breadcrumbs were all there, perfectly in place, perfectly in line. And, I'm not totally sold on her going from, like, ruthless killer, like woman bashing a skull, to becoming a big ol' softy so quickly. And, I mean, that Leventhal twin yelling at her to stop beating up the dude who was planning on eating her? That don't wash, does it? I mean, if I see the big, scary, bald guy who just ate my bus driver and was coming back to eat me get his ass kicked, I think I'd be okay with that. I think I'd be on board. I don't think I'd be crying about that. Now, as for the text piece, I did like the line drawn between Two-Face not having to ever make a decision, and how while he is a slave to the toss of a coin, he's also kind of liberated by it. And that was, I thought that was clever, and I'm sure that that line's been drawn before, but it was very, very effective here. Overall, I don't think I would tell you to hunt this one down, or don't break your back hunting it down, but I also wouldn't tell you not to, because it was okay. I mean, I'm not mad that we read it and talked about it, but I don't know, I guess you really can't get much more of a middling review than that, eh? I mean, if what I do is reviewing anyway. But I think that's about all I got to say here. How about we hop into the mailbag? I was going to do a little dip into Wizard today, but since next episode is going to be kind of a, like I said, it's going to be a sit rep where we're just going to get like the lay of the land right now in Gotham, I figure maybe it'd be better to do it then. I'm not done scripting that one, so we'll see how long that one runs, and if there is room, we'll do some wizarding then. But how about we hop into the mailbag? This is the Robin 54 edition of the mailbag, and we're going to start with our friend Chris Yu. And he says, this was a fun issue. It managed to advance the ongoing narrative from before Cataclysm while still firmly being a Cataclysm / Aftershock story. This feels like a Robin issue and not just another part of a crossover. And that's true. I did like that. I did like that it did walk the line. You know, it was very much dealing with the after effects of the cataclysm, and it was taking place in the new normal, but it was also very, very much an issue of Robin here. He was dealing with his cast, his co-stars, his supporting characters. It was not a forced cash grab of an issue. It felt very much like it should have felt. And I think that's where I waxed nostalgic about the post-crossover Quiet issues that I used to love so much, especially among the X-books, and how this issue felt a lot like that. Chris continues. He says, Tim's dad, because I asked about Tim's dad. I didn't remember him being such a, I don't know, like a naive goofball, you know? I remember him being, we'll get into it as we go here. Chris says, Tim's dad was like the Aunt Harriet of this era. He served no purpose other than to be the obstacle that Tim had to operate around in order to be Robin. The need for Tim to have a living parent to distinguish him from the other two previous Robins, who were both orphans, just added an unnecessary complication to his character. And that's true. That is true here. I do recall Tim's dad being very much an obstacle or just a hurdle that Tim had to kind of sneak around. And I think that was pretty cool, actually. Of course, he's treated in this issue like he's like very, very stupid. But I guess, you know, he'd still notice his kid, you know, climbing out a window in a very, very bright and colorful costume. And I gotta say, I love the reference to Aunt Harriet. I think it was last episode I said I was never really a fan of the Batman 66 show. But I do remember Aunt Harriet being kind of the thing they had to sneak around in order to be Batman and Robin. And I remember years ago doing a bit of research on Aunt Harriet when Reggie and I were covering the Comics Code Authority and how Aunt Harriet, one of the, you know, big rumors, or maybe it was confirmed, but like one of the big talking points was that they added Aunt Harriet so it wouldn't just be three men living at Wayne Manor back at, you know, in the 50s. And I just found her such a weird and almost fascinating character. Because it's like, why didn't she adopt Dick after his parents were killed? She moved into the manor. What? Very, very bizarre. Very, very bizarre. And it further reminds me, I was reading some pre-crisis Detective Comics not too long ago. I went on a little binge. I found a pretty good run in like a $2 bin. So I was like, oh, I'm gonna grab these. It was even before NML Crossing became a thing. I just picked them up because they were cheap. And I remember in the letters page, it was almost like a running gag. Like, I think I bought like six books, and in four of them, someone asked the question, whatever happened to Aunt Harriet? And it would always be answered with like ellipses, like dot, dot, dot. Like, we're not talking about Aunt Harriet. Very, very silly stuff. It just really tickled me. And I tell you what, I'm actually quite surprised nobody's brought her back. Just, you know, as a gag, as a silly little funny ha-ha. But at the same time, I gotta say, I'm glad nobody actually has. Now we're gonna go to our friend Eric, who's writing a response to Chris Yu here. He says, I agree. Tim's father was an obstacle in this era. This is probably why they decide to kill him off eventually and have Tim become the first Robin. No, he's not Noodles. He is a teenage sidekick. Where was I? Have Tim become the first Robin that's adopted by Bruce Wayne as his actual son. This could also be part of the plan that Tim would be the next Batman, which is something we've talked about before as well. This is different than Dick and Jason, where Dick was Bruce's ward and Jason only had Bruce as his legal guardian. I know depending on what era is being read, those details change each crisis event. Currently, Bruce calls all the Robins his sons, regardless of the past continuity. Now, I definitely do remember Jack Drake being killed off. I want to say it was an Identity Crisis, which I don't know, it was like kind of in the ether back then in the comics industry, where you had like these writers come in who wanted to tell stories that didn't exactly work. You know, they didn't really fit so good in like the wider continuity, but they had these stories they really wanted to tell. And Marvel and DC were both very, very proud to have these writers do their thing. So we get Identity Crisis and we get Civil War. And I'm pretty sure comics haven't recovered yet and probably never will, because we just keep going back to these same wells. Our buddy CJ also chimed in on this subject. He says, I'm also agreed on Tim's father being the obstacle of this era, and that's probably why he was killed off. And to that, maybe, maybe not. You know, I want to go back to Eric's point here where Tim not being an orphan, Tim having a living parent who was involved in his life, differentiated him from the other Robins. I think, you know, I hate that that was taken from him. But again, this was the age of Identity Crisis, and this was also the age where DC was being run by a guy who wanted to kill everybody. Dan DiDio, what was his saying? There will be blood or there will be death, you know? That was his, like, big catchphrase, which is pathetic, and it's lazy. It's real lazy. Where, you mean, I mean, there are ways. I mean, Peter Parker's been sneaking around behind Aunt May's back for 150 years now. And they always figure out ways to do it. Like, why can't Robin sneak around his dunderheaded father? It's just because Dan DiDio is a two-trick pony. It's you kill or maim, or you reboot the universe. That's about it. Back to CJ. He says, while I like the first Robin adopted by Bruce Wayne angle, that it element that it added, I didn't like killing Tim's dad. I liked that this made him a little different than the other Robins, and it would have made a possible future of Tim as Batman also different and interesting. Killing Tim's dad just makes Tim another tragic hero slash Robin who has central tragedy. It might make his character more streamlined and archetypical, but I think part of the joy of legacy heroes is seeing new takes on that hero. I would have rather they evolved Tim's dad as a character in his role in the series in a different way. And like I just said, I agree 100%. And I definitely appreciate you taking it a step further here with Tim as Batman with a living parent. Because that totally changes the dynamic. And I mean, because like Batman is motivated largely by the death of his parents. And we could have a Batman who wouldn't be. You know, and I think that could have been, it could have been interesting, but it also would have been very challenging for the writers. And I think if we found a writer up to the task, it could have led to some very, just different stories, different sort of stories, different motivations. And it's a shame that they went the road more traveled, right? I guess it's the easier way to do it. It's almost like saying that they're fated to be this way. And that's unfortunate. And like I said earlier, it's kind of lazy. But thank you guys so much for writing in and sharing your thoughts on that and leading to some real fun, thought exercises there. I don't remember the last time I thought about Jack Drake, so it's pretty cool to be able to do that here and to have such wonderful conversations. So thank you all so much. And of course, if anybody out there would like to join in on these conversations, I encourage and invite you to do so. You can find me several different ways. Chris is on infiniteearths.com, weirdcomicshistory@gmail.com. Look me up on social media. I'm at most places, some more than others, but I'm around. I'm not hard to find. But with all that said, let's take this one home where I can thank you all so much for sharing some of your day with me today. And until next time, as always, I'll talk to you again real soon. See ya. Makes it harder to think straight, starting over after it breaks.